Today it walks on two legs and will be delivered by a messenger of steel, I think, nodding at Greg as we get ready to enter the lit hall. I ease the door open after hearing the click and seeing the green light. Peeking quickly in both directions with the mirror, I withdraw it and ease the door closed. Hallway with a security door at either end. There's a camera mounted above the door on the right. We'll have to move fast. There is most likely a small room with other security doors that allow only one to be open at a time. There may be a security station set up off that room that overlooks a larger congregation area, I say. How do you know that? Greg asks. We had to study prison systems in detail, as a lot of other types of secure buildings are set up in a similar fashion. A prison is one of the most secure facilities around. Well, there are those that are more secure, a lot more, but the premise is the same, I answer. We'll move quickly down the hall, have a brief peek in the window to see what we see, open the door, and move inside. Once inside, we're trapped until that door closes, assuming it's set up that way. You help it along its way. It may be pneumatic, so there may not be much you can do. If shit happens, we move back here and into the main building to find a place to lay low, I continue. I'm right behind you, Greg comments. I would take out the lights with my suppressed 9mm, but the lights are inset into the ceiling with wire mesh glass. They're designed to not be broken. I would also take out the camera, but it's surrounded by a thick plexiglass shield. Again, it's designed not to be broken easily. Well, here's to hoping Fat, Dumb, and Happy is supposed to be watching the cameras, I say, swiping the card. We're in the hall in a flash, moving rapidly to the door on the right. Crouching and stealth are fairly moot at this point. I thought about just walking up nonchalantly like we were part of the group, but with a group this small, they would most likely know each other, and the ruse wouldn't work. I've actually done that in the past with some degree of success, but there's a time and place for it. This isn't one of them. My heart is racing along with my feet. We're now in the light and most likely being caught on camera. Speed is of the essence. The reaction will most likely be slow if we're seen on a monitor. Chances are the operator will go through a small moment of what the fuck. Trained ones will react instantly, but these people are far from being trained. I would have worked a different tactic altogether if we were infiltrating a secure building with trained security. Back then, I also had different tools to work with. These are a bunch of yahoos who think they own the world. They're lax in their security, but it only takes one lapse on my part, and even they will react. I shoulder my M4 and withdraw my handgun, quickly peering in the window while Greg crouches at the card swipe. It affirms what I envisioned from experience and from Jim's descriptions. A small room with large wire mesh windows waits on the other side. Two security doors lead out of the room, one to the left and one to the right. The one on the left leads to a room that looks similar to the console room on the upper catwalks of the large room. I can't see all of it from my angle. A large room filled with tables and chairs is beyond the small room on the other side of the door. Four stories of catwalks surround the room, with security doors leading to the four wings that radiate out from this building to the actual cells. The room is dimly lit, including the guard post to the left, and I don't spot any guards. Time is of the essence. I nod at Greg. He swipes his card, and I hear the now familiar metallic click of the magnetized locks releasing. I sweep the door outward only enough to crouch through and settle by the door to the left. Light from the hall fills the small room. The bottom of the window in the door leading to the guard post is above my head. I have my handgun pointed upwards toward the window. The round won't go through the glass, but if someone opens the door, their life will be measured in nanoseconds. The light from the hall dims as the door swings slowly closed. My heart is pounding in my chest. I hate being exposed like this. My body tingles from the sheer volume of adrenaline pouring through it. Time moves slowly, and it seems like it's taking the door way too long to close. If someone is in the room, they surely would have seen us on the cameras and have noticed the increase in light. I lift my signal mirror to one corner of the window, exposing only enough of the mirror to see inside. A man is sitting inside, with his feet propped up on one of the consoles, and reading a book. He glances over the window briefly, before returning to the book. While I didn't get my fat wish, I certainly received my wish for dumb and happy. A rifle leans against a counter nearby, and a handgun is holstered at his side. The door behind us clicks as the door shuts and the magnetic lock engages, shading the area in the dim light from the room. I watch as the man looks over to the door. He removes his feet from the console and sets his book down. Still looking at the window with a quizzical expression, he rises from his chair. "Now," I say, nodding at the door swipe. Greg runs the card through. The door clicks and I push inward with my shoulder, my hand still holding the mirror. I rise as I push, sweeping my Beretta past the opening door. I stop as the barrel aligns with his face, which registers shock. I fire at almost point-blank range. Blood flies out from his head as my round hits on the side of his nose, shattering it and the sinus cavity which lies behind. My barrel aligns quickly again, and I send a second round, on the heels of the first, into his already demolished face. The round penetrates just below the inside portion of his eye. The back of his head explodes outward with pieces of flesh and brain coating the side window. He flies backward, hitting the counter below the window, and the ruined back of his head smacks against the glass. He slumps and rolls to the ground. The window is smeared with chunks which slowly slide downward, some of the larger pieces falling off onto the counter. Blood streams down the glass in rivulets. The room fills with the smell of gunpowder and blood. I crouch back down, quickly looking around the room. Greg is squatting by the open door looking outward. Nothing moves. I move back into the small room and allow the door to close. We open the other door, wedging it to keep it that way, and enter the room proper. It has the appearance of where meals are taken and free time spent. A bank of phones line one of the walls. The doors leading to the upper wings are dark, but light shines from two of the doors across from us on the ground floor.
Makes sense that they would keep them on the ground floor, I think.
Our lasers streak through the room as we search for any other guards. The room is empty. Walking around the perimeter, hidden in the shadows to a degree, Greg and I approach the first lit window. We pass by one darkened window, but found it vacant. It could be that they're all empty, but the odds are that the ones with the light are where the current prisoners are housed. A look in each of the doors reveals a long hall with rows of solid steel doors to the left and right down its length. Each door has a very small window, and the cinder block walls are painted a drab cream color. At the far end of each, a guard sits in a plastic chair against the wall, each one looking bored and not wanting to be there. One guard is leaning forward with his elbows on his knees, staring at the ground, while the other leans back with a book. Neither is being attentive to the door, or those most likely behind the locked doors. Both have rifles, leaning against the wall beside them. I stand next to the wall adjacent to the opening of the door. Greg swipes and pulls the door outward on the click of the magnetic release, holding the door with his foot as he focuses on the other lit door. I step into the opening, raising my M4. The first guard lowers his book to look at who is intruding upon his moment. Centering the crosshair on his center mass, I pull the trigger twice, feeling two light kicks against my shoulder. The two projectiles streak down the hall, the first tearing through the pages of the book before impacting his chest with a solid thump. The book is torn from his hands and flies through the air. The second round arrives on the heels of the first, smacking into his neck. The wall behind him turns red with a spray pattern of blood. The guard reaches up with his hand to his ruined throat
and launches back into his chair. Jets of blood arc into the air through his fingers, with the rhythm of his heart. He slams against the wall, knocking his gun to the ground with a clatter, spins to the side, and falls off his chair, hitting the floor. Continuing to grasp his neck with both hands, his feet kick out repeatedly before slowing to an occasional twitch. One last twitch, and they become still. I race up the hall, keeping him covered. A large red puddle forms on the floor beneath his head. I reach the body and kick the rifle away. It skitters across the floor, leaving a streak of red behind. The guard's eyes stare blankly at the ceiling above. Any life they may have once had is gone. The sound of the shots barely echoed down the hall. The solid doors must have kept even the muted gunshots from entering, as there are no faces peering out of the windows. I look quickly in each one on my way back out, finding men lying on double bunks in several of the rooms. I reach Greg's position, aware of our need to be swift. Anyone could come through that entrance at any time, or see us through the window if they drew near. They can't get in with the door wedged, but they certainly can raise the alarm. I don't know the guard's rotation, so we need to make this fast. Greg closes the door, and we creep to the second door. In the same positions as before, Greg swiftly opens the door, and I send two rounds down the hall once again. The guard looks up from his leaning position, his face registering surprise at a figure in the door aiming a carbine at him. His shocked look changes to one of pain as the bullets punch through his shirt, one just to the right of his sternum in the center of his chest, and the other into the sternum itself. He's thrown upright and from his chair into the wall. He falls heavily to the floor, scooting the chair across the floor away from him. The chair hits one of the security doors and topples over. I hear a gurgling wheeze as I approach him. His eyes seek mine and lock onto them as I reach and stand over him. Fear is written in his eyes as he tries to catch his breath. He knows he's dying. His eyes plead with mine for a second, and then he looks away with resignation. His red plaid shirt puffs as I pump two more rounds into his chest, which then falls inward. The wheeze of him struggling to breathe falls silent. I turn and see the face of a woman staring out of the small window of the door that the chair crashed into. I nod at the woman and head back to Greg. We rapidly check the remaining wings without seeing guards or lit rooms. And there should be switches in the guard post that'll open all of the doors, I say as we finish with our checks. I'll unlock the doors if you'll gather everyone.
Gotcha,
Greg says. I head into the room, having to do the musical door thing again. Checking on the hall leading to the other building on my way, I find it still clear of others. Within the room is a console and control panel for the doors. The console allows for each door to be opened individually, a wing at a time, or the entirety of the doors. I unlock the two wings that have the lit hallways, radioing Greg that they're open. I then move to the small room to keep watch on the hall. I open and wedge the door again. Greg appears in the room with men in tow, and then heads into the second hall, returning shortly with women behind. I wave them over to my position, noticing more than a few eyes wandering to the blood-smeared window of the control room.
I hid the bodies in cells, Greg says as he comes to stand next to me.
Now let's drag this other one into a cell before we leave, I say, nodding toward the control room. Is this everyone? I ask the group, knowing there's at least one woman missing. One of the women looks around at the others before speaking up.
There are four women missing. The guards take some of us at night,
she says.
Fucking great, I say quietly.
The man who was beaten just a short while ago is with the men. One of his eyes is swollen completely shut. He's shirtless and his face is smeared with dried blood as if he, or someone else, tried to clean him up.
My wife,
he says, the words thick and slurred, coming through broken, swollen lips. Tears run down his cheek as he thinks about what she must be going through. "We'll get her," I reply with a nod. "Anyone here know Allie McCafferty?" An older gentleman, well, older being relative as he appears to only be slightly older than me, raises his hand. His eyes light up, and his face is written with eagerness and anticipation.
"I have a daughter named Allie McCafferty. Do you know if she's okay? Is she with you?"
he asks excitedly, and looks around as if she'll materialize somewhere. "Assuming she's your daughter, and the odds are that she is, she's okay. She and others will be waiting for us outside come morning," I answer. Tears flow down his face. I want to ask about McCafferty's mother, but it's not my place and time is not our friend. We need to get these people to safety and quickly. With Greg standing at my side, I whisper, "We need to get these folks back to the laundry room and maybe further into the building before someone shows up, possibly even back to the roof. I'll lead. You keep the stragglers rounded up." I think about staying here as there's only one entrance and we can keep the door closed by keeping another open, but there's no other way out. If they come back to check on the prisoners, like I'm sure they will at some point, they only have to wait us out at the other end. We'd eventually have to leave for food and water. In essence, we'd be trapped.
"That'll be a little akin to herding cats, but I'll keep them moving," he replies.
"We may have to move them into the hallway in stages if they won't all fit in the transition room," I say, to which Greg nods. "Okay, folks, we're gonna get you out of here to somewhere safer. I'll be leading, and Greg here will be behind you. Stay together and behind me. A lot of the route will be dark, but keep moving as best you can unless I say different. Keep absolutely quiet. No talking," I say.
"What about my wife?"
the hurt man asks.
"And the others?"
the woman who first spoke up asks immediately after. "We'll get them, but we have to get you to safety first. You first, then them," I answer.
"Please hurry,"
the man says with desperation and fear in his voice. "We will. You ready, Greg?"
"Ready as I'll ever be."
Greg and I move the body into an empty cell before returning to the group. There are 27 men and women, not including Greg and me. It's one of the tightest squeezes ever, so tight that several pregnancies may occur, but we manage to fit everyone inside. I swear the windows bulge outward and the oxygen is immediately consumed. The door closes with a click. We're so tight that I'm almost not able to raise my hand to swipe the card. I'm also hesitant to do so as we may spill into the hall once the door unlocks. Heck, I may fly down the hall from the pressure and impact the far door at close to Mach. None of this happens as the door swings open. I head down the hall, keeping an eye on the opposite door until we reach the door we entered through on the left. I enter with the others close on my heels in the hall. I can't blame them for bunching up and pressing close. They can't see well, if at all, in the inky blackness of the corridor. Greg notifies me over the radio when he enters behind the group. Reaching the security door at the end of the hall, I clear the area before opening it and dart quickly down the hall, branching off to the left. I retrace our steps back into the longer hall. The group makes more noise than I'd like. They're trying to be quiet, but it's hard with a group this size, and they don't really know how. To me, we sound like a herd of spooked water buffalo. I hear several gasps behind me as we pass the floor covered with blood and clotted with chunks of flesh and tissue. There is a much defined iron odor of blood, along with feces. A faint, lingering odor of gunpowder lies just below the other overpowering smells. We pass through the door and into the laundry room without incident. I'm not sure how long we have until our intrusion and the missing prisoners are noticed. "What do you think? Here or the roof?" I ask Greg once we're all in the room with the laundry baskets.
The roof will be easier to defend, I think," Greg answers. "Unless they have grenades or mortars," he continues with a chuckle.
If they find us and come at us with grenades, then nowhere's really safe. All right, take them to the roof and hole up there. I'll join you shortly, I say.
And you're going where?
Greg asks. Back. There's a bill that needs delivering.
Oh, how come you get to have all the fun while I babysit?
Hey, payback for all the running comments, I reply with a shrug.
Duly noted. See you shortly.
Replacing the mag with a fresh one, I head back, entering the long hall and proceeding down its length. Keeping to the walls, I crouch through the dark shadows, scooting rapidly through the lit portions. My nerves are taut, expecting a cry of discovery. Although we hid the bodies, the evidence of what transpired is readily available. And there's the fact that none of the prisoners are in their cells. It won't take long for the alarm to be raised if someone ventures that way. If it sounded, I'm going to have to give up rescuing the other women and head to the roof. We'll be able to hold them off there for a good while with only one entrance. I'm tired, but filled with anxious energy. The adrenaline has been pumping into my system. While I was able to sustain that for long periods of time in the past, it now tires me quicker than it used to. I crouch at the far door after checking for all clear.
Okay, Jack. Let's do this. This is a no-brainer, I whisper, psyching myself up. I raise my goggles at this point. There's no one to see that they're not in place, and I see better peripherally with them off.
I open the door and slither through, easing the door closed behind me. Going to the left this time, I enter a door and hall exactly like the one on the other side. Reaching the door leading into the lit hall, I halt and think things over. The layout will be the same as on the other side, but the guard situation will be different. They may have a guard posted in the control room, or they may not. There isn't really anything to secure on this side if they're using this to bunk down in. There may not be anyone, or there may be men all over the place. I assume they're free to move around as they choose, so they could be meandering anywhere. I'm also thinking the cell doors are permanently left unlocked.
Only one way to find out, I whisper to myself again.
I unlock the door and whisk down the lit passageway against the near wall, moving briskly to the door. I peer inside. The room is dimly lit like the other one. There are two differences. Three of the doors leading to the wings on the ground floor are lit, as is one high up on the fourth level. No one is within the large room. Now, to see if anyone's in the control room. I swipe the card and enter, keeping low. As the door slowly closes, I bring the mirror up to the window and observe the room as empty. Luck is still with me. A click behind me tells me the entry door is closed, and I open the one to the room, entering and pressing close in the shadows against the wall. I'll keep an eye on the lit windows, searching for a telltale shadow that someone is approaching the door. My heart thuds in my chest. I am in the lion's den. If someone enters at this point, I'll scurry back to the small room and hope the door closes before they can get to me. If I open the hall entryway and wedge it open, they won't be able to open any of the doors to leave. I would take this as a sole option if I knew there weren't others to be rescued somewhere inside this area. I smile, thinking of them waking to find a door open and them not being able to get out. That would be worth putting a wireless camera on the wall and watching their actions. Edging to the first lit door, I crouch by the entrance. I rise, about to glance in the window, when the light dims, causing my heart to skip a beat and pump in a fresh supply of adrenaline. Someone is close to the other side. I cross low under the window to the hinge side and crouch a little more than a foot from the hinge. It wouldn't do to be right behind the door if it opens, as it could hit me. Being farther away allows the door to open wider before making contact. The light in the window darkens further. Someone is drawing closer to the door. I'm hoping it isn't a lot of them. Actually, I'm hoping no one comes through the door, but if any do, a crowd of them is low on my wish list. I prop my M4 against the wall next to me, preferring to use my Beretta if anything happens in close quarters. The door begins to swing outward, without the corresponding click of a maglock being disengaged. They've somehow managed to unlock the cell doors. It stops, and I see a head pass by the window. A man walks out into the room, and the door begins its slow journey back. Only one man exits, and he begins walking across the room carrying an AR-15-style carbine over his shoulder. If he turns for any reason, I'll be in plain sight. I would let him go, but I don't for two reasons. I don't want someone behind me, but more importantly, he may be going to the other side. I'm not in a good position for any alarm to be raised. Tracking him with my 9mm, I pull my knife from the sheath strapped to my lower leg. The carbine shouldered at his back will interfere with a knife kill to that side, so I keep the gun in my right hand and knife in my left. The door closes with a faint thud. I tense, waiting for him to turn at the sound. There have been a few times I've come close to being caught by someone turning instinctively at an innocuous sound, even one they created. If he turns, I'll have no choice but to fire, even though it's the louder option. His head begins to turn. I tense, the sights of my handgun aimed firmly at his head. He turns back to the front without turning fully around and keeps walking. I relax and push away from the wall, check the window quickly to make sure it's clear, and begin crouch-walking silently in his tracks. I close to just behind the man, getting ready to rise up and plunge my blade into his kidney. "Damn it," the man says, almost under his breath, and turns. I swiftly rise as he turns, jamming the end of my suppressor into the meaty portion under his chin, and fire. The bullet crashes through the soft tissue of his mouth, going through his tongue and into his upper palate. A section of his cranium explodes upward, spewing part of the inside of his head into the air. The only noise is the sound of the slide racking back and sliding forward. The spent cartridge bounces across the floor a few times and comes to rest. The man crumples downward, and I catch him under his arms before he can hit the ground. I drag him to the wall, deposit him in the shadows, wipe the end of my handgun on his shirt, and place my knife back in its sheath. Returning to the door, I retrieve my M4 and holster the 9mm. I'd prefer to use my 9mm inside the rooms, but the length of the hall and the chance of someone else emerging from a room dictates the use of something with a little more accuracy over a greater range. Plus, if the alarm is triggered and they come out en masse, I'll have an auto option. I clear the hall and slide inside. Peeking in the window of the first cell to my left, I see a man lying on a lower bunk with his hands behind his head, staring straight up. He's either lost in thought or asleep. I look in the window of the cell across the hall. There, a man has his pants down and is bent over a naked woman kneeling at the side of a bunk. I have found one of the women. A sickness settles in my stomach, and anger rises. I open the door just enough to slip inside. With the door only partially open and closing, the sound of my shots will be muffled even further. Both the man and the woman look my way. The woman is sobbing and whimpering. The man's face registers first anger at being intruded upon, and then shock as my carbine comes up. My round enters the side of his head and exits the other, coating the ruffled blankets and pillow in red. He crashes to the bunk beside the woman and slides to the floor. The young woman draws in a deep breath, ready to scream. I hold my fingers to my lips, hoping to catch her scream in time. She bites off her scream and nods. Tears have made pathways down her face, and her red eyes regard me. She exhales with a whimper, sniffing loudly once. I double-check that the man isn't moving or emitting any noise. Holding my hands up and out to my side, not wanting to alarm the woman further, I take a step toward her. She hasn't moved from her position and cowers into the bed. "Ma'am, I'm not here to hurt you, but I need you to get dressed and wait here until I return. I also need you to be very quiet. Can you do that?" I ask. Her frightened, wide eyes continue to look at me fearfully, but she nods. She looks over to the man on the floor and then begins searching the room for her clothes. "Okay, good. Just be brave a moment longer, and I'll be back. I'll get you out of here. I promise," I say. She nods again and rises to her knees on the floor, covering her nakedness with her arms. She's sobbing quietly. I turn and exit the room, heading across the hall. The man is still resting with his hands behind his head and facing away from me. I ease the door open and slip inside. He turns his head toward the door and appears to be about to say something when my round slams into the top of his head. The bullet tears through his skull, the soft brain tissue, and then exits out the lower part of his face, tearing his right jaw from its hinge. Blood sprays down the front of his shirt. His arms and legs twitch violently on the bed, becoming sporadic tremors, and then he's still. His jaw lies at an angle to his head, held on only by a portion of his cheek. I head down the hall, going room to room, with similar scenes played out in each. The next wing plays out the same. I find one other woman and have her come with me after I clear the rooms. I take her to where the first woman is now sitting dressed and on the bunk with her arms around her drawn-up knees. She flinches as I enter, but calms immediately when she sees me. Tears still run down her face. Both women are a wreck, and rightfully so. I figure it'll be better for them to be together. I tell them to stay put, and the woman I just brought sits on the bunk. They wrap their arms around each other's shoulders. Replacing my mag, I clear the third wing in a similar manner. Apparently, the men retired to their rooms for the night and aren't wandering around. Most are asleep or close to it when I enter. Each and every one of them are now experiencing the first few moments of their afterlife. I find a third young woman, the wife of the man who was beaten, and bring her to the other two after having to spend some extra time calming her down. It took a few minutes to convince her I wasn't one of the others. I step out into the main room and look upward to the fourth floor, where light shows from a door to one of the wings. There's a fourth woman, and I'm guessing she's up there. I haven't run across Preacher Man or any of his entourage yet, so I'm guessing they're taking residence above. "This one may be a little trickier," I think, looking upward. If they're his personal bodyguard, they may be more alert. At least some of them will be. I feel tired and dirty. I know my face must look like a mess, as I felt several splashes against it from some of the men. I'm using that term loosely here, as I took them out. When I get home to Cabela's, I am taking the longest shower of my life. It'll be measured in days. I apprise Greg of my progress and my plan. Greg's response is faint with the radios having to go through so many thick concrete walls, but I hear him acknowledge me. I think about taking the three women to him before heading to the fourth landing. If something happens to me, they'll be left here and I won't have helped them much. There's still time before dawn approaches and the teams begin their journey down, so I'm not as caught up with a time crunch as before. However, I'm here, and the situation is pretty much under control, although that could change in an instant. "Well, there's nothing to it but to get to it," I say quietly to myself with a sigh, and I start for the first set of steel steps leading to the catwalk above. Setting my boots carefully on each rung in order not to let my steps ring out, I cautiously climb to the first catwalk level and mount the stairs leading to the third level, and then the fourth. The door with the light shining through the small window is the second one down. I ensure the first wing is empty before crouching at the lit window. Peering in, I see an empty hall like the others. Apparently, Preacher Man only feels secure with his bodyguards, I'm assuming that's what they are, being close by. I open the door quietly and make my way down the room as on the lower levels, increasing Hell's count one soul at a time. I reach the last door and peek in. Sure enough, it's the one who thinks he was called to purify the earth. He's standing with a woman on her knees in front of him. He has a handful of hair and a gun to her head. I can't go in like the other rooms. If I take him out, he could have a responsive twitch and shoot the woman. I swing the door open and step inside with my M4 aimed at his head. The woman turns her head to glance at me, and Preacher Man whips his around.
"Who the fuck are you?"
he asks angrily. "I'm the last person you want standing in this room with you," I answer.
"Put that gun away or I'll call my guards,"
he says, not releasing the woman or moving the gun from her head. "You mean the ones who are soaking the bed sheets with their blood?" I ask.
"You'll never make it past the others," he says, his eyes widening a touch with fear.
"This is just not your day for being right, is it?" I say. His eyes widen further.
"Stay back or I'll shoot her,"
he says, thrusting the gun harder against the woman's head.
"Oh, go ahead, she means nothing to me. It's you that I've come for," I reply. "But I tell you what, you have two doors to choose from. One, you can shoot her and I shoot you. Or, two, you can release her and I let you go. A life for a life, either way. You choose." The door closes. His eyes dart around the room fearfully, as if a way out will appear, before coming back to rest on the end of my suppressor, only a few feet away, and pointing unwaveringly at his head.
"If I let her go, will you let me go?"
he asks. "Yep," I answer.
"Okay, I choose door number two," he says.
"That's the one I'd pick," I say. He releases the hold on her hair and removes the gun from her head. The woman scrambles to her feet and backs away from him, wrapping her arms around her body. "Ma'am, go into the hall and wait for me there," I say. With a look at the man and then at me, she scurries past me and out the door. "Nice and slow, set it on the ground," I say, nodding at the gun he's holding at his side. I track his every move, waiting for any quick movements as he kneels slowly and sets it on the floor. He then stands back up.
"Are you clean and pure?" I ask.
A confused look crosses his face.
"Yes, I am,"
he answers with a quivering voice. "Good, and that'll make your transition easier," I say. The confused look continues. His eyes then widen as he catches my meaning.
"But you said..."
he stammers, backing up. "Oh, I lied." The bright flash highlights his open-mouthed fear, as if caught with a camera. Part of his brain, which once held his very confused and warped thoughts, splatters on the concrete wall, his life-giving blood streaking down to the floor. The muffled gunshot lifts him from his feet and slams him into the sink against the wall. He falls to the side, slumping over the steel toilet.
Fitting end,
I think, gathering up the woman's clothing and leaving the room. The woman is squatting in the far corner by the door with her arms wrapped around her. Her body is shaking.
Is he?
She asks with a trembling voice. I nod, setting her clothes on the floor beside her.
Good,
she spits.
All of them?
Yes, ma'am, I reply, turning around so she can get dressed as well as keep an eye on the far door. She finishes quickly, and we head down the stairs to the other women. There could still be others patrolling that we missed, so I remain alert. Gathering the women, we start back through the building, with me clearing the route and them behind me. One of the women still occasionally sobs, but we make it to the roof stairs without encountering anyone. I let Greg know that we're coming, and we trudge upward, stepping out onto the roof. I take a deep breath in anticipation of feeling the refreshment of the chill night air. I do get my breath of fresh air, but forgot about the dead cattle in the distance. The air that rushes into my mouth and nose is tainted with the undertone of thousands of dead, rotting carcasses. It's only a little better than the stifling and stale air inside. The ambiance of that building is thick with the horrors of what went on inside. The sky is clear, and the moon casts light downward, making for good visibility. The wife of the man looks around the group huddled together on the flat roof. With a cry of discovery, she runs to where her husband sits. He stands, and they embrace. He flinches with her tight hug from his injuries, but folds his arms around her.
"Oh, you made it," Greg says as I move over to him. "Does that mean the bill has been delivered?"
"Paid in full," I answer.
"Good.
You look like a mess," he says, eyeing my face. "I feel like a mess," I say. "There's the release of tension in finishing what we came to do. The adrenaline ebbs and an overwhelming tiredness replaces it. I'm gonna lie down and rest. Keep an eye on the door."
"Will do,"
he replies. We're interrupted a few times by the men and women coming over to thank us. "Thank us later. We're not out of here yet," I reply a couple of times. A shriek sounds out from far away, like the faint howl of a coyote on a still summer night, almost forlorn. I feel adrenaline try to enter into my already tired system, but exhaustion has set in. All heads turn toward the distant sound. We all know what that sound is, and it strikes dread in all of us, especially as we are all outside. Perhaps we should go inside, I say to Greg.
Might not be a bad idea, although I kind of like it out here, he replies.
Yeah, me too. But that could change in a hurry, I say. I really don't want to move again, but I'm sure our scent is being carried on the night air. We're still a few hours away from dawn, and not out of danger yet. Greg and I gather everyone up and head inside. There are a lot of bumps and some curses as the others shuffle and grope in the dark. We find a large room close to the bottom of the stairs and hole up for the night. There's no place like home. The rest of the night passes without incident. I take the first aid kit and administer what I can to the man who was beaten and whipped. We get little rest, although Greg and I take separate watches in order to try and recoup some of our lost sleep. At daylight, we move through the tangle of corridors until we find a way out into the sunshine. We walk around the large prison structure until we find the loading docks. The walls cast shadows deep into the compound from the low-lying sun of the morning. Several pickup trucks are parked in the loading area. There should be enough to bring everyone out, but if not, we'll scout the area and find others. Horace and the teams should be about an hour or so away if they left at daybreak. I would open the rear gate, but I'm not sure these people didn't have friends that might show up. The sky promises another clear and brilliant blue day. That, of course, means another warm one. My eyes feel dry and gritty with the lack of sleep, but we'll hopefully be here only one more day. I feel so grungy, But that isn't an entirely new feeling, just one I didn't really want to be having in my later years. During the wait, I let the ones who were held captive know about our place, and that they're welcome to come with us. If they want to stay in the area, we'll make sure they get to where they want to go. Most take us up on our offer, wanting to leave this place and the horrid recent memories. Some have family in the area and opt to stay. There are plenty of weapons inside, and I offer up a team to escort them in when they arrive. Greg radios and communicates with Horus as the sun rises to the top of the wall. They aren't far away, and arrive at the rear gate 10 minutes later. We lift the big bar holding the gates shut, and the teams drive in. Bree exits and runs over to give me a big hug.
"I'm so glad you made it, Dad," she says.
"I'm glad to see you too, sweet Bree," I reply. Robert strolls up shortly after. "How was it?" he asks. "It was okay," I answer with a shrug. Yes, we do have that in common.
"Dad!"
I hear a shout and look up to see McCafferty running to the group of people gathered off to the side.
"Allie!"
I hear her dad call back. I give Horus a brief description of our encounter and the plan to take some of the others with. I ask Greg to take Echo Team in as an escort for the ones staying to gather up weapons if they want them. Some are reluctant to venture inside, but he gathers a few and they disappear into the building, returning a while after. We gather the ones going with us, 22 in total, and start allocating pickups with drivers and riders.
"What about using one of the cargo trucks?"
one of the soldiers from Blue Team asks.
"That won't work," Robert answers. "We have to go around that one town, and those cargo vehicles won't make it through the fields."
It makes my heart proud to have him analyze this in that manner.
"Did they bother you this time through?" I ask.
"No, not a sign of anyone, sir,"
Horus answers. McCafferty, the dirt on her face streaked by just-wiped tears, walks over with her dad trailing just behind her.
"Sir, thank you," she says.
"No worries at all. I'm just glad you found your dad," I say. She continues standing, looking a little uncomfortable. I tilt my head to the side, inviting her to say whatever is making her uneasy.
"Sir, I know this isn't really appropriate, but may I?"
she asks with a quiver in her voice and holding her arms out to the side. I'm confused by what she's asking, but only for a second.
"Of course, I'm not a rabid dog," I say, shouldering my carbine.
McCafferty gives me a quick hug.
"My mom didn't make it, but thank you for finding my dad, sir,"
she whispers, choking back a sob. I'm surprised the smell of my fatigues doesn't make her pass out, but she withdraws mostly intact. Her dad steps up. We introduce ourselves, and he shakes my and Greg's hand.
"Thank you both so much, and thank you, Jack, for taking care of my precious Allie. I want to thank this Sergeant Connell as well when we get back. You have no idea how much this means to me," he says.
"Sir, you have no idea how many times McCafferty here has pulled our bacon out of the fire. So our making sure she's happy and safe is more a matter of self-preservation," I say. "You have quite the warrior here." We brief our ordeal of travel and plans for the return trip. The ones staying say they can find their way, so we leave them a couple of the trucks and depart. The drive back to Cannon AFB is uneventful, and we arrive with the sun overhead. Miguel and his group are waiting on the ramp, standing around a myriad of vehicles. The afternoon is spent searching for the ammo bunkers. We eventually find them, located near the airfield itself, but away from the base buildings, for obvious reasons. We transport crate after crate and load them into the AC-130. We have a lot of people and a lot of ammo to take, so we opt to leave the Humvees here. The 130 can carry quite a lot of cargo, but its capabilities aren't endless. Besides, there are plenty of Humvees at Fort Lewis, so they won't be missed. The heat is no different from the other days,
and I'm thankful for the evening, which brings cooler temperatures. We flight plan our return trip and plug the info into the flight computers. Robert will lead when we depart in the morning, with me tagging along in an extended formation. I'm absolutely exhausted by the time the sun touches the western horizon. I just hope we have a pleasant and uneventful flight back. I'm so ready to be home. I think of Lynn, and the longing becomes even more pronounced. Oh, I'll be there tomorrow, hon, I say into the sky, as the sun drops below the horizon, and we seal up for the night.
The night before, toward the end of the hunt, Michael felt a huge pull in the recesses of his mind. He was enjoying the thrill of being on the hunt, chasing down prey, and running under the night sky. Even though that part of him was tucked away in the back of his mind, he felt a call of anguish and fear. Opening up, he searched and focused on the source of the pull. Images of fear and frustration surfaced from a large pack, actually several packs co-located in one lair and unable to leave. Trapped and hungry, they were close to succumbing. Michael knew he didn't have the time to make it, as they were a distance away. Instead, he sent the images of alternate food sources wrapped in the packages he'd found. He told them to hang on, and he would be up the next night to help if he could. With that, he shut down and finished his hunt, with the lightning of the sky chasing him back to his lair. Tonight, Michael sets out immediately north to where the trapped packs are located. It will take some time, and he may have to find another lair for the evening. It takes him over 2 hours to reach their location. He arrives tired from jogging this far, but it's really not much farther than what he usually travels on his nightly hunt. Finding that the large lair is encircled by a wall similar to the one at the two-legged lair, Michael sends images to the packs inside that he is there, and trots around the entire circumference. Close to the end of his trek around, he comes across one of the strange vehicles the two-legged ones use. It stretches high into the air, a little away from the wall. He wants to see what is inside, and scales the vehicle to get a better vantage point. On his perch, he sees over the top of the wall, and looks into the compound. A large building stretches tall and covers a large area. Many of his kind are standing in the yard and in the parking lot looking in his direction. They haven't been able to get out and hunt. He feels their hunger, feels their fear and entrapment. He receives images of them being able to find some packages last night, but those were few and far between. What they found kept them alive for another night, but not much beyond that. Michael searches the area for a way out, but finds nothing that registers as a solution. One series of synapses fire, and he wishes the vehicle he is on was on the other side of the wall. If it was, they might be able to leap the distance from it to the top of the wall. More synapses fire, triggering a series of thoughts and ideas that flood his mind. A light flares in his brain, and one of the thoughts locks into his head with an almost audible snap. If they can build something on the other side, they might be able to scale the wall. Michael sends a flurry of images to the others in a simplistic form that they will be able to understand, the gist of which is to gather anything and everything they can find and start piling the objects against the wall, building it high enough that they can climb up and jump over. The packs turn and disappear inside. They return at intervals with chairs, tables, boxes, and a sundry of items. The pile of items quickly grows and eventually reaches the top, to the point where the packs can climb, scale over the top, and drop to the ground. They are free. He feels the release of their fear, feels their gratitude and eagerness. He also feels the pack leaders wanting to follow him. This causes Michael to pause. He isn't ready to lead large packs yet. This night and the revolution in his thought processes make him want to stay alone and think about things further. However, here is a large pack in front of him, settling on a decision. He calls them together and heads south with them following on his heels. The gathering has started.
With the revelation of the Night Runners and their apparent ability to open doors, we put chains on the crew doors and ramp, securing them to the fuselage. The controls are infinitely more complicated than just a plain swinging door, but you never know. It's the million monkeys theory, and they could accidentally hit on a series of maneuvers that cause the ramp or crew door to drop. Inside, the night passes quickly, and, for a change, we aren't visited by roaming packs. Perhaps the dead Night Runner bodies outside are keeping them away. Who knows? The day dawns and I wake with energy, because I know I'm heading home, and I get to see Lynn. My heart has been aching with missing her. This whole apocalypse thing has really put a damper on her homecoming. Our thoughts of just kicking back and chilling together on her return have not only been put on the back burner, they've been taken off the stove entirely. The aircraft are already loaded, so it's just a matter of having breakfast, doing our walk-arounds, and getting airborne. Miguel's group brought items as well, and each aircraft is packed with as much as it can hold. Robert, Craig, and Bree settle into their seats. Radio if you have any problem at all, and stay out of the clouds. If we run into weather that precludes keeping out of them, divert and we'll try another day, I say. Okay, Dad, Robert replies and begins going through his checks. I settle into the AC-130. The interior of the aircraft is much different than the interior design of other 130s. The left side of the cargo compartment is made up of the weapon systems mounted on hydraulically operated platforms. A series of racks against the fuselage on the right behind the weapons hold ammo for the guns. This particular model is a newer one with a General Dynamics 25mm Gatling gun, which is an electric Gatling gun and has an amazing high rate of fire. One Bofors 40mm autocannon, and one 105mm M102 howitzer. All in all, it's a lethal weapon platform. A battle management control center occupies the center of the compartment on the right, between the autocannon howitzer positions and the forward 25mm cannons. The capabilities include day-night radar, all-light level TV, and infrared detection. Greg will be the co-pilot with both Gonzalez and McCafferty filling the flight engineer role. With the back filled mostly with crates of ammo, we have very few of the passengers on board due to weight and space restrictions. I see the props begin to turn in Robert's 130 next to us, and I start through my own checks. The list is different, but only in minor ways. I have to basically do most of the items myself, so we're behind Robert. He has his engines fully running when our first one begins its rotation. Soon we're ready, and I follow him to the runway. I see him start down the runway, and he's soon rotating into the morning sun. I pull onto the runway, and am in the air shortly after, pulling into a trail position behind and to the side as we slowly climb into the bright blue of the sky.
4.5 hours. Please let the weather be kind to us, I think, as we level off.
The return flight is actually a smooth one. It gets a little bumpy as we begin our descent over the Cascades, but for the most part, it's gone relatively well. I call base when we're about a half hour out and setting up for our approach.
Jack, it's good to hear you're back. Wait one and I'll go get Lynn,
Kelly responds to my call.
Jack, I'm glad you're back. Everything go okay?
Lynn asks a moment later. Yeah, just peachy, I respond.
Oh, great. I know what just peachy means. Yeah, I'm glad you're back, though. I missed you.
I really missed you, too. We brought extra dinner guests. Can you let Bannerman know to expect more and lay out some extra settings? We'll also need some of those school buses to meet us at McCord, if you wouldn't mind, I say.
I'll let him know, and I'll meet you up there. How many have you brought back? How far out are you?
She asks. I think our count came to 80, and we're about a half hour out, I answer. It'll be good to see you.
Wow, seriously? 80? That's pretty amazing. It'll be good to see you as well, Jack. Okay, I better go if we're gonna meet you. See you soon.
We land and taxi onto the ramp, parking by our old HC-130 friend. Vehicles soon approach, with two school buses following. I greet Lynn with a big hug and kiss. Oh, it feels good to have her in my arms again. I expect to hear something about the condition of my fatigues and her inability to breathe, but she merely looks up with those beautiful blue eyes of hers and smiles. It takes a little while to make the introductions, but the people and gear are offloaded and put into vehicles. Nicely done, I tell Robert, with a pat on the back as we close up each aircraft after they're emptied. Thanks, Dad, he beams. You too, Bree, I say. She just gives me her award-winning smile. I'm so proud of them. We leave the ammo crates on the aircraft, as there's no need to transport them anywhere. I am tired, and seeing Cabela's brings a surreal feeling. I'm not sure if it's arriving back or the past few days that feels surreal. Both seem a little weird. It was only a few days that we were gone, but it feels more like it's been years. Kind of like a homecoming after an extended absence. Nothing really looks all that different, though. It's still early afternoon, and I notice a lot of the semis are missing from the lots as crews are off doing their thing. It looks like business as usual has been going on while we've been away. We pull to a stop and begin offloading. Michelle runs out of the building and throws her arms around Robert. Bannerman is also there waiting for us. He introduces himself to the newcomers and takes them away to show them around, brief them, and assign them places. With the influx of people, we're close to 200 in our group now. Before they leave, I notice McCafferty's dad approach and thank Lynn for saving his girl. Lynn and I find some time alone to catch up after things settle down. At first, it's hugs and kisses, but then she asks about the trip. I fill her in on our little escapade. She just shakes her head as I retell our story.
You know, this is not what I envisioned for a homecoming, she says as I finish the story.
I know, hon. Me neither.
To be honest, Jack, I'm a little pissed about it. I figured we would have all the time in the world to just relax with each other. You know, wake up and find a nice day to take the kayaks out and shit like that. I'm back and you're traipsing all over the place and I never see you, she says.
I know. This is...
Shush, I'm talking,
she says, interrupting my response. I give her a big smile. I love the way she does that. She does it in a nice way and without a trace of condemnation or anger. Just her wanting to voice her thoughts and have me listen.
I wish you'd quit leaving me behind to worry about your sorry ass. I get why, but I want there to be a point where you aren't leaving seemingly all of the time, she says,
looking at me as we sit on a curb with the sun's rays bathing us. I'm listening, but also enjoying the sun and the nice day, as it comes without the heat of the southwest. It's warm, but a nice warm. You worry about me?
Okay, for real? You have these headaches and fever. You slip into a coma and awaken, claiming you can talk to and hear animals. Of course I'm worried about you. And not just for those reasons. I don't know what I'd do without you. I'm almost looking forward to the day when you can't fly anymore. Then at least we can be together, even if it is in this fucked up place, she says. And before you start in, I know you have to go out again for the rest of the families. I just don't have to like it.
Look, I have something to tell you that you may not like even more, I say with a sigh. Lynn looks over with a flash of worry. I proceed to tell her everything about what's going on inside. The hearing, the night vision, the ability to not only sense night runners but understand what they're saying, that I think they can sense me, and that I have the ability to hide that sensory aspect. Everything.
Who else knows?
She asks after a moment of digesting what I've told her. Gonzalez, I answer.
Gonzalez? You told her before me?
She saw some things and put two and two together. She asked me about it, and I told her some, but not what I just told you, I answer.
Anyone else?
Lynn asks. No, I haven't even told Robert or Bree. I really don't know if I should tell others or not. To be honest, it kind of scares me, along with what their reaction might be.
I really don't know how to answer that, Jack. I don't think the others will react badly, though,
she says, reaching a hand up to stroke my face. I love you, I say.
I love you, too.
We sit in silence a moment longer, enjoying each other's company on this glorious day. An utmost feeling of peace fills me. This is another moment I don't want to end. I sense Lynn feels the same way, so we just sit and relax with each other. She chuckles at some thought that crosses her mind. What? I ask.
So you haloed in, eh? Are you seriously crazy?
Is that a trick question?
Only you would come up with an idea like that,
she says lovingly. We spend the remainder of the afternoon in the sun, acting like we're on vacation at the beach, just kicking back and talking. It's good to be home. At the meeting that night, I catch everyone up on events. I then sit back and am caught up on things here. We have a lot of the water tower apart and we'll be able to begin transporting it soon, Bannerman begins. With the people you brought in today, we're close to being overcrowded. We'll need to figure out soon what we're going to do for living quarters, whether that's in the eventual move up to base housing or building our own here. We need to do something soon. We're okay for now, though, right? I ask. For now, yes, but we're going to have to do the meals in shifts. Not everyone will fit in the dining facility. We could have people just gather their meals and take them elsewhere or do the shift thing, he answers. Well, whatever you think is the best way is fine with me. Okay, I'll think on that one. We also just about have the walls up around the maintenance facilities. We're a little slower on the base housing walls, but we should be finished within a week or so, Bannerman says. Awesome. Let everyone know they're doing a great job. Hopefully we can give everyone a few days off when we finish, I say. I'm sure they'll appreciate that, he replies. Now that you're back, are we planning to hit a distribution center? Driscoll asks. I'd like to do that soon, I answer. Good, because we could use the supplies, especially with you always finding strays to bring home, Bannerman says. Just when you think he's lost his humor somewhere, he manages to locate a batch of it. Are we okay with crews and teams if we head up tomorrow? Yeah, we should be. We have the wall crews and those on the water tower, along with others who tend to the livestock. But with you returning, we should have enough, Bannerman responds. Okay, let's head up tomorrow and take a look. I'd also like to plan a time to start clearing out the night runners in the area. If the distribution center is good enough for our supplies, we should think about leveling the entire area of buildings and night runners, I say.
I think we should take a look at the DC before making